Tonight I want to talk about this title I gave for the talk, which was Arrows to Flowers. This is a traditional image taken from the time when the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree, about to become enlightened, and it was sort of like his dark night of the soul before he reached enlightenment. And I came to this topic because it's a part of what I've been reading in Pema Chodron's book, When Things Fall Apart. There was a whole section about this. And it struck me as interesting because I'd seen these images before and heard these images before, but I'd never actually found them in the Pali canon or in any, traditional Pali teachings. And I actually went out and searched. And sure enough, in the Pali canon, all the stories of the Buddha's enlightenment, these things just don't exist at all. So then I looked further, and a friend suggested I look at something called the Buddha Karita, which translates roughly as the life of the Buddha. Now, this is a Sanskrit text, so it was written some time, centuries literally, after the Buddha's life, and it's kind of a hagiography. It's very sort of flowery. It's very sweet, and I like what I found of it. I didn't read the entire thing, where the Buddha is going through his enlightenment, and basically Mara is coming to tempt him, and he's being tempted in a variety of ways. Mara does the usual traditional thing of, offering him great wealth and great power and these sorts of things, which is actually very parallel to what happened in the Bible with Jesus and the devil coming when he's in his 30, 40 days in the desert. So these are traditional images in a sense. And then Mara sends his three daughters to tempt the Buddha. The Pali name of the three daughters translate as greed, hatred, and delusion. So we understand these are symbolic daughters, but it's like they don't have any success. So he's offering him all this good stuff. And finally, Mara just gets really ticked off. He says, I'm trying to be a Mr. Nice Guy. No more Mr. Nice Guy. I'm just going to like really let all my demons loose on you. And that's where we pick up this story, in a sense. So this is, but the great sage, having beheld that army of Mara thus engaged in an attack on the knower of the law, remained untroubled and suffered no perturbation. Then Mara commanded his excited army of demons to terrify him. And forthwith that host resolved to break down his determination with their various powers. That's just like the demons are being unleashed. One, rising up like the sun in full splendor, rained down from the sky a great shower of live embers. But that shower of embers, full of sparks, when scattered at the foot of the Bodhi tree, became a shower of red lotus petals, through the operation of the great saint's boundless charity. Others, having become great clouds, emitting lightning and uttering the fierce roar of thunderbolts, poured a shower of stones upon that tree, but it turned to a pleasant shower of flowers. Another set an arrow in his bow. There it gleamed, but it did not issue forth, like the anger which falls slack in the soul of an ill-tempered, impotent man. But 5 hours shot by another stood motionless and fell not through the saint's ruling guidance. And then at the end it says, when the flower armed god thus fled, so basically Mara's finally given up. He tried all his things and he didn't. They call him the flower armed god because he traditionally is dressed in flowers and trying to make himself look beautiful, right? Had fled away vanquished with his hostile forces, and the passionless sage remained victorious Having conquered all the powers of darkness, the heavens shone out with the moon like a maiden with a smile, and a sweet-smelling shower of flowers fell down wet with dew. So this is obviously all very symbolic images, right? This isn't like reporting what actually happened. And this is, you see similar images, like I mentioned, Jesus in the desert, but also Jesus when he's being baptized and this dove comes down and rests on, comes down from heaven. In Hindu mythology, Shiva is showered by flowers at some point when he achieves something. So these are images that indicate the Buddha was looked upon as this holy and virtuous and wonderful person. But basically what's being symbolized here is that the Buddha at this point, here he is sitting there about to become enlightened, has learned to be totally non-reactive to what's arising in his mind, which is the intention of Buddhist practice when you look at it in the broad sense. I mean, we can't control what's arising in the mind. We can't control Mara. We can only control our reactions to Mara. So Mara isn't evil. Mara is not a bad guy. Mara is life. Basically, life happens. Stuff happens to us all the time. And what we're trying to learn to do is not be reactive to it. We want to, when these things happen, when these arrows get shot at us, use the image, uses another version of this story, they don't have any effect. In fact, as they come towards us, they just turn into flowers. Or as it says in one verse there, they're suspended in air. They don't have any effect, even though arrows are being shot at them. So I want to look at what Pema Chodron has to say a little bit here. And this is, first of all, her introduction to this. On the night in which he was to attain enlightenment, the Buddha sat under a tree. While he was sitting there, he was attacked by the forces of Mara. The story goes that they shot swords and arrows at him, but the weapons turned into flowers. So this is the original impetus for this talk. I read this paragraph and went looking for this image, and I had to search for it quite a bit to find the thing here. And even what I found, the Buddha Kriya, isn't identical to this at all. So this is a story that's sort of been amplified and changed. Apparently the Buddha Kriya was originally written in Sanskrit, it then got translated into Chinese, and it got translated into Tibetan, and eventually into Japanese. And of course, with that translation, it changes a bit because the cultural variance arrives. So she may be talking about the Tibetan version of this story, because that's Pema's background. Right? And then this is what else she says. And this is where the bulk of this talk is going to be. There are four Maras. So this is from the Tibetan point of view. There are four forms that Mara takes in our experience of life. The first Mara is called Devaputra Mara. It has to do with seeking pleasure. The second one, called Skanda Mara, has to do with how we always try to recreate ourselves, try to get some ground back, try to be who we think we are. The third Mara is called Klesha Mara. It has to do with how we use our emotions to keep ourselves dumb or asleep. The fourth one, Yama Mara, has to do with our fear of death. So those are the four categories. And what I'd like to do is like continue looking at what Pema has to say, but then sort of compare and contrast it with things I found in the Pali Canon and also on commentaries on the Pali Canon to sort of see how these teachings are in parallel, even though they're expressed in somewhat different ways. So the first one is Devaputra Mara. So if you look at this up in Wikipedia, the Devaputra Mara is the deva of the sensuous realm seeking sense pleasure. So this is a goddess that's always just after pleasure, right? And so I want to read two things. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. If I can get to the right page here. So he says, we live in a world where we naturally encounter a wide assortment of appealing sense objects, sights and sounds, tastes, sensations, interests in thoughts and ideas. Desire arises from contact with these pleasing objects. And this desire can range from obsessive passion to addictive craving to a simple wish for something. All of these gradations of feeling are the expression of the wanting mind. It's important to distinguish here between the desire of wanting associated with greed and the desire of motivation, which can be joined with either wholesome or unwholesome factors. In English, we use the same word for these two very different mind states, whereas in Pali, the language spoken by the Buddha, different words distinguish the various meanings of desire. In Pali, the word tanha means the desire of craving. You know that? I want it, and I want it now. And the word chanda is translated as desire to do. For example, you all have the desire to do to come and sit and hear the Buddha's teachings today. That would be called a wholesome motivation, a wholesome intention. That would be chanda. Okay? And he goes on. The grasping force of tanha runs very deep in our consciousness. In fact, the Buddha said that this kind of desire or craving is the drive force of samsara, the entire round of existence, of life and death. Desire, wanting, craving, clinging are all expressions of the greed factor in the mind. We feel it as thirst for a particular object. In fact, thirst is another translation you sometimes see for tanha. We become entranced by the appearance and seduced by the pleasant feelings that accompany it. So there's the basically what you know. There's those daughters of Mara dancing for trying to seduce the Buddha. Right? At that time, we cannot clearly see the two nature phenomena: their impermanence and selflessness. Observe carefully what happens to your mind when it becomes entranced in the forest of desire. It is like being lost in an enchanted maze, or wrapped in the elusive dream world. We weave many thoughts and fantasies around the experience we either are having or want to have, and we bind ourselves in the chains of attachment. Which pretty strong language, and it's definitely what we do. We want something, and we become gripped by that want, and then we go to all kinds of lengths, either just mentally figuring out how am I going to do this and that, and we can weave down those stories about how it's all going to happen, or we actually try and act out in some way to make it happen. Neither which is a very successful strategy, as we often discover. So, and let's see what Pema has to say here. And she has a different slant on things. The Devaputramara is a good description of how we are all addicted to avoiding pain. When pain arises, we reach again and again for something that will blot it out. Maybe we drink or take drugs or just chew gum or turn on the radio. We might even use meditation to try to escape from the more awkward, unpleasant, and penetrating aspects of being alive. That's an interesting statement. We may even use meditation. So we can, meditation just becomes a way to spiritually bypass, using the current language these days, to avoid having to deal with the painful aspect. Well, I'll just go into this blissful meditative state and I won't have to deal with all this stuff. Someone has just shot an arrow or raised a sword, and instead of allowing it to change into a flower, we run, trying to escape in all kinds of ways. There are, of course, endless ways of seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. However, we don't have to consider seeking pleasure as an obstacle. Rather, seeking pleasure is an opportunity to observe what we do in the face of pain. Instead of trying to avoid our uneasiness and off-centeredness by running away, we could begin to open our hearts to the human dilemma that causes so much misery in this world. We could realize that the way to turn this Devaputra arrow into a flower is to open our hearts and look at how we try to escape. What she's, of course, describing here is mindfulness. Actually looking at the sensation, the mental sensation, the mental flavor of this overwhelming desire, this craving, and just looking at it, not trying to change it, not judging it, not saying I shouldn't be doing this. That's very important. We don't want to ever get into caught in the self-blame loop of, oh, there's something wrong with me, I'm full of craving all the time. That just means you're a human being. So what we have to do instead is just honestly be able to just look at it. And then it loses its power. It loses its grip because we've seen it for what it is. It's just more craving. That's all. I can just turn, as she says, you can turn that arrow into a flower just by looking at it and going, that's okay. I don't need to follow this thought through to the end of how I'm going to get this stuff, whatever I happen to be craving. And then the next of these is Skanda Mara. Skanda is Sanskrit. In Pali, that Skanda translates roughly the English word aggregate, or more colloquially, heaps, piles. And this is the Buddhist teachings on the five aggregates of clinging. This is the principal way the Buddha talks about and gives us a way to try to understand how we are constantly trying to cling to our sense of a separate self. This is where the Buddha talks about this more than any place else. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the collected discourse, there are 159 suttas about the five aggregates of clinging. So this is like we're trying to somehow keep a sense of self. And yes, this is a verse. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, as I mentioned. This is one of those 159 suttas. It's actually just a small section. And here, in many places in the sutta, the Buddha is talking to a Brahmin, or sometimes to a Deva that's come to hang out with him, or in this case, a householder. So someone has come to the Buddha and asked for teaching. And this is what the Buddha has to say. How, householder, is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? Here, householder, the uninstructed worldling, that's us, who is not a seer of the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not a seer of superior powers and is unskilled and undisciplined, regards form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. He lives obsessed by the notion, I am form, form is mine. He lives obsessed by these notions, that form of his changes. As he lives obsessed by these notions, that form of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of form, there arises in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. So this is, form is the first of the five skandhas, the five heaps. I'm not going to go, I could give a whole talk just on the five skandhas, so I'm not going to do that tonight. But like what he's saying, and it's interesting, like he's saying, he gives you four different ways. Sometimes I think I am form, and sometimes I think form is mine, or I think The form as self, or self as possessing the form, or form as in self, or self as in form. All these different ways of thinking about it. And so the Buddha is being very thorough here. He's saying, no matter how you think about it, if you identify with form as you, as self, as separate self, that's when we get into trouble. Because that, inevitably, that form, whatever that form is, changes and deteriorates. It disappears. It goes away. It's just the nature of all things. Things arise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. And when they go, then we, as he says, where there's lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. Because we thought that was thing was going to be there and it was going to be permanent and that me, and it's gone. It's changed. It's going. And we find it very difficult for obvious reasons. This is what Pema has to say. She once again approaches this from a slightly different point of view. Skandamara is how we react when the rug is pulled out from under us. Nice image. We feel that we have lost everything that's good. We've been thrown out of the nest. We sail through space without a clue as to what's going to happen next. We're in no man's land. We had it all together, working nicely, when suddenly the atomic bomb up and shattered our world into a million pieces. We don't know what's going to happen next or even where we are. Then we recreate ourselves. We return to the solid ground of our self-concept as quickly as possible. So something happens that just blows us away. And all of our ideas of how things are and how things should be or how things were or all our ideas of how we had it all together and everything was great are gone. And what we do to solve that, to fight that arrow, is try and recreate ourselves, perhaps in a different, slightly different image, but we try and recreate ourselves as soon as we can. Our world falls apart, and we're being given this great opportunity. This is Pema's view. However, we don't trust our basic wisdom mind enough to let it stay like that. Our habitual reaction is to want to get ourselves back, even our anger, resentment, fear, or bewilderment. You know, better familiar things than nothing, right? So we reach our solid, immovable personality, as if we were Michelangelo chiseling ourselves out of marble. Instead of tragedy or melodrama, this Mara is more like a situation comedy. Just as we are on the verge of really understanding something, are allowing our heart to truly open, just as we have the opportunity to see clearly, we put on a Groucho Marx mask with fluffy eyebrows and a big nose. Then we refuse to laugh or let go, because we might discover who knows what. Again, this process does not have to be considered an obstacle or a problem. Even though it feels like an arrow or a sword, if we use it as an opportunity to become aware of how we try to recreate ourselves over and over again, it turns into a flower. This is the basic message of the Buddha's teaching on the five aggregates of clinging. It's if we really start to see, either, you know, in this case, because something has rocked our whole system, or just through practice, we start to see, oh, wait, there I am, selfing again. And it's a term I really like, the idea that we can actually self. You know, go ahead and actually try and create a more self. And we do this all the time. We're always we're selfing. So that's the second of these maras. Then we have the next one, which is Klesha Mara. Klesha is Sanskrit. In Pali, it's Kalesa. These are like the five Kalesas are a traditional teaching in the Pali canon about obstacles to practice. You know, each of these kalesas is an obstacle, it's a problem. The thing about that image, the thing about that presentation, is they it sounds like these kalesas are something solid, real. You know, we have to somehow learn to struggle against them, overcome them, remove them, which often leads us to overstriving, pushing too hard, becoming either grim or discouraged because we can't, we keep pushing against them, and there they are again, and there they are again. And this is a very traditional view of them. This is from Anilayo. Anilayo's book Satipatthana. This is a PhD thesis on the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions on meditation. And here's what he has to say. He's talking about the instructions on the five kalesas in the sutta. The use of the term hindrance clearly indicates why these mental qualities have been singled out for our special attention. They hinder the proper functioning of the mind. Under the influence of the hindrances, one is unable to understand one's own good or that of others, or to gain concentration or insight. Learning to withstand the impact of a hindrance with awareness is therefore an important skill for one's progress on the path. So there's that language. We have to withstand the impact. We have to struggle against it. But there's another way you can look at this, and I quite like this. I heard someone speak this about 15 months ago when I was on retreat, and I'm another translation of the word kalesa could be veil. So it's not some big, heavy object that we have to push around or push out of the way or overcome. A veil is something that sort of just covers our natural light. You know, we have this natural wholesomeness, but the veils are covering it over. The veils being the kalesas. So the kalesas dim or distort our natural light from shining through. But the light is always there. It's not that innate wholesomeness we actually possess isn't always there anyway. It's always there. We just can't see it because it's veiled. So we don't have to struggle against the kalesas so much as shrug off the veils. I like that thought. It's like, this is something I have to let go of these energies as opposed to having to fight against them. We have to sort of clear up the distortion. In the sutta there is actually quite an interesting set of five images that the Buddha uses in this particular sutta to describe the five kalesas, right? And basically, the images there's a bowl of water, and you're looking in the bowl, trying to see a clear, undistorted image of yourself. So you're actually seeing your true self. But there's all these ways that the image is distorted, and each of the kalesas has a separate image. And I think these images are quite useful because they sort of, these are different kinds of veils. Okay. So this is suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water mixed with lac, turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. It's also interesting that when the Buddha does these sorts of images, these are the people in his day would have understood immediately. These are all like, this is how people used to dye cloth 2,500 years ago in India, right? So, this is something that the common people would all understand, even if maybe we don't. So suppose, Raman, there's a bowl of water mixed with lac, turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So the image is distorted. So too, Brahman, when our mind dwells and is obsessed and oppressed by sensual lust, desire, craving, on that occasion, even those hymns that we have recited over a long period do not recur to the mind. So, we can't, our mind doesn't function correctly. Because what does a Brahman do? A Brahman just chants the verses. That's what a Brahman did all the time. And he can't remember even the simple ones because his mind is distorted by this energy. And so we go on. Then the suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So imagine you're looking down at the bowl of water and it's boiling. This is a good image because this is the image for anger, for aversion, for all those sort of aversive energies. Think about it. When you're angry, there's that English phrase, I got really hot. And that's what happens. Anger, literally, we get a heat. And so if you're looking down into this bowl of steaming, boiling, you get burnt. You get scalded by your own anger. So this is a fiery, bubbly veil. But it's still just a veil. All I have to do is take the pot off the stove. Let the veil calm down. But we have to be aware enough that we can do that. That we can actually just take the water off the stove. That we can take that veil away. Suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water covered over with water, plants, and algae. So this is the image for a sloth and torpor, the third of the kleses. Sloth and torpor is like, I don't know, who cares, blah, blah, blah. Just sort of laid back, inattentive, fuzzy. And so here's the images, like there's water, and the guy's clean water, but there's this scum on top of it. That's what our mind feels like. When we're caught in sloth and torpor, it's like things are so scummed over. We're in a fuzzy, cloudy place where we don't really know what's going on. We're just lost. We're caught in this place. Mm. Then the next one. Suppose, Brahman, there's a bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into the wavelet. So now you look into the water and your image is all jagged. There's nothing solid. You can't really see clearly. You see little tiny bits so that they're always sort of wiggling and jiggling and moving around and appearing and disappearing. This is the image for restlessness. That energy where we just can't sit still. Or our mind won't go still. I mean, if this is on a mental level. But often you have a physical, when you're caught in this space mentally, when this veil is active, we're also like shifting around in our chair. We literally can't sit still. Because things are just blown around too much. And then the final image is, suppose, Ram, there's a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, placed in the dark. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection, etc. So this is doubt. Doubt is has this sort of all-pervading sort of feeling. So here, the whole, not only just the surface of the water, like we had when we were just dealing with sloth and torpor. Now we're dealing with the whole bowl of water is just full of dirt and messy. And, even if we sort of dig down into the bowl, it's all clouded. This is what doubt does to our mind. And the doubt clouds the mind, literally. It's like this huge cloud where we just go, oh no, how could I possibly have thought that? Or blah, blah, you know, all those energies that doubt has. So I like these images because they have this sort of sense of, none of these are solid. This is the bowl of water stuff mixed into it or floating on top of it or mixed into it or sort of blown by the wind or heated up. But in all these cases, we could always just, dump out, take the scum off the top. With doubt, this is interesting actually, with doubt we actually have to replace the water. With doubt we actually, okay, time to get rid of this old dirty water, let's put some fresh water in the bowl. And once again, that's all we have to do. It's not like it's an immovable object. It's just something we have to go, oh, here's something, I can remove this veil if I just choose to. Okay. Emma, of course, has a somewhat different take on this, but I think it's interesting nonetheless. When everything falls apart, we feel uncertainty, disappointment, shock, embarrassment. What's left is a mind that is clear, unbiased, and fresh. But we don't see that. So we've just been at, we've just crashed into one of these obstacles. Our mind is clouded. When everything falls apart and we feel uncertainty, disappointment, shock, embarrassment, what's left is a mind that is clear, unbiased, and fresh. What an interesting thing to say. Like, so we just, our world fell apart. That means I don't have any preconceptions of how things are going to be. I'm just like, oh my God, what's going on now? But we don't see that. Instead, we feel the queasiness and uncertainty of being in no man's land and enlarge the feeling and march it down the street with banners that proclaim how bad everything is. We knock on every door asking people to sign petitions until there's a whole army of people who agree with us that everything is wrong. We forget that what we've learned through meditation and know to be true. When really strong emotions come up, all the doctrines and beliefs that we've held on to seem kind of pitiful by comparison, because emotions are so much more powerful. So what began as an enormous open space becomes a forest fire, a world war, a volcano erupting, a tidal wave. We use our emotions. We use them in their essence. They are simply part of the goodness of being alive. But instead of letting them be, we take them and use them to regain our ground. We use them to try to deny that, in fact, no one has ever known or will ever know what's happening. That's a great thing. We use them to deny that in fact no one has ever known or will know what's happening. We use them to try to make everything secure and predictable and real again, to fool ourselves about what's really true. We just sit with the emotional energy and let it pass. There's no particular need to spread blame and self-justification. Instead, we throw kerosene on the emotion so it will feel more real. Again, we do not consider this process an obstacle or a problem. If we can look at and see the wildness of emotion, we can not only begin to befriend and soften towards ourselves, but we can also begin to befriend all human beings and indeed all living beings. By becoming aware of how we do this silly thing again and again, because we don't want to dwell in the uncertainty and awkwardness and pain of not knowing, we begin to develop true compassion for ourselves and everyone else. Because everyone has emotions. Everyone suffers in this way. Everyone gets rocked by emotions all the time. And when we can sort of just sit with them, we start to have respect for ourselves and not judge ourselves. Often when we get caught in these emotional storms, we then the second storm is now, and it's all my fault. I shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't be full of anger. I shouldn't be full of lust. I shouldn't be full of greed. I shouldn't be full of whatever it is I'm full of today, now, this minute. We just blame ourselves. And once we can get past blaming ourselves, then we can see, oh, all those other people who are caught this way, not their fault either. There's no blame. It's just how people are. And somehow we're learning to be non-reactive. These storms of emotional energy arise, and we go, oh, it's my old friend, lust. Here I am again, telling myself those fantastic stories about how things could be, or how they were, or whatever. And just sort of laugh at ourselves. That's often the best solution to any strong emotion. You can laugh at yourself being caught. Oh, here I am yet again caught in this crazy emotion. Very powerful way to sort of take the sting out of them right away. Okay. Finally, we have Yamamara, the fear of death. Once again, I want to read what Pema has to say first. I think maybe all of the Maras arise from fear of death, but Yamamara is particularly rooted there. When we talk about a good life from the usual samsaric point of view, what we mean is we've finally gotten it together. We finally feel that we're a good person. We have good qualities. We're peaceful. We don't get thrown off balance when arrows are shot at us. We're the person who knows how to turn an arrow into a flower. We feel so good about ourselves. We finally tied up all the loose ends. We're happy. We think that's life. Ever end up in that place? It's pretty familiar. It's like, oh, we somehow think we can get it all together. That if I could just figure it all out somehow, I could put life together in such a way, I'll just be this really good, pure practitioner, and everything will be wonderful. We think that if we just meditated enough or jogged enough or ate perfect food, everything would be perfect. But from the point of view of someone who is awake, that's death. Seeking security or perfection, rejoicing in feeling confirmed and whole, self-contained and comfortable, is some kind of death. It doesn't have any fresh air. There's no room for something to come in and interrupt all that. We are killing the moment by controlling our experience. We somehow, that urge to be in control, to have it all together, to be this image of ourselves as being perfect and in control, stops any chance of anything actually happening because we're putting so much energy, we're gripped so tightly by this need to be in control all the time. You know, if I can't be in control, there's something wrong with me. And that just doesn't work. It's the best way I can put it. It just doesn't work. And so, basically, what I'm trying to get across here is all of this has to do with mindfulness, right? Everything I've talked about is just, if I can be mindful when Mara is attacking me, then I can change those arrows that Mara shoots at me into flowers. It's just another thing to notice. It's just another thing to be mindful of. My problem is these things happen and I try and make them into big deals. Somehow I got to solve it. So it's a big deal. As opposed to this is something that's happening now and I know because everything's impermanent. that this is going to go away. All I have to do is sit with it, just be with it, be okay with it, be able to say, oh, now anger's here now. That's okay. My old friend, here it is back again. That's okay. I don't have to judge myself or shouldn't be angry. Just, this is what's happening now. And say, and that's okay. Without acting it out. Often these strong emotions, old storms, when they arise, create not only the mental level of action, but we have to do something out there in the world. This is when we cause suffering for ourselves and for others, when we're trying to act out of these places. If I can just see it and go, okay, yep, that's what's going on. I'm kind of cooking right now, but that's okay. So basically, there's a, and you see this in many places in the sutta, the Buddha says, or someone says, I see you, Mara. I see you, Mara. I see what's going on here. I'm not caught by this. It can become like a way we deal with these things, because then we become mindful of them. And then, you know, all we have to do is in our mind go, oh, I see you, Mara. Now Mara's lost its power. Mara works only when it's not seen, when it catches us, when we're whirling around, caught in the storm of Mara's arrows, or when we're sort of writhing in pain by all these arrows sticking in us. And I'm not for one second saying that stuff doesn't happen that's horrible in our lives, that is really unpleasant and painful. But what happens is, those things happen, and then we're caught in a storm of emotion and stab a few more arrows into ourselves in the process. As opposed to going, oh, this is what I got now. This is not very pleasant. That's okay. I have to somehow be able to say, I see you, Mara. And then the arrows all turn into flowers. That's the essence of what I have to say. I want to say one more thing, of course. Those of you who know me know I can give a Dharma talk without leading a bit of poetry. And this particular poem seemed apropos to things tonight. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. It's called Deep Summer. The mockingbird opens his throat among the thorns for his own reasons, but doesn't mind if we pause to listen and learn something for ourselves. He doesn't stop. He nods his gray head with the frightfully bright eyes. He flirts his supple tail. He says, listen, if you would listen. There's no end to good talk, to passion songs, to the melodies that say this branch, this tree is mine, to the wholesome happiness of being alive on a patch of this green earth in the deep pleasures of summer. What a bird. Your clock, he says plainly, which are always ticking, do not have to be listened to. Repeat that, because your clocks, he says plainly, which are always ticking, do not have to be listened to. The spirit of his every word. I love this. This is like, how often are we caught up in emotional storms have something to do with the time sequence? Oh, that happened and this happened. Or, oh, this is going to happen in the future. Or, oh my God. You know, it's all, we think that somehow there's only a limited amount of time and I have to figure this out. I have to do something. I got to fix it. As opposed to just going, that's okay. Just ignore that ticking clock and just be with the moment and then the next moment and then the next moment. That's all we have to do. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.